You can proceed, counsel.
May it please the court. This court acts for itself in conducting a complete and independent review of the record below in a summary judgment case involving a confidential informant. That confidential informant operates under a long-standing original agreement. That's a reward agreement under the IRS Special Agreement Program that's not well known. And then that morphs into a services agreement that's mutually amended 3 years
later. I have a number of clarification questions.
Yes, Your Honor.
On page 19 of the blue brief, you say that Judge Kaplan from the Court of Federal Claims, quote, did not extend the same courtesy to then permit confidential informant to come forward and directly refute the contentions. What does that mean?
Yes, Your Honor. The in that part of the brief, the briefing was completed in summary judgment. The court then issued orders asking the parties to counsel to appear at the August 24th, 2017 hearing on summary judgment. Prior to that, there were a number of preliminary orders to that hearing requesting that counsel for the respondent address issues that were not addressed on brief by counsel for the government. So we, at that point, are in the hearing explaining these various questions for the court and going through that. The hearing leaves with the opportunity to produce some records and to work together in a way, and then to also address issues. We attempted to file a proffer, a motion for leave to respond to the things that were stated at the hearing, and to respond to the things that they were asked to discuss.
Well, that's a question of the rules, is it not?
Your Honor?
Isn't that a question of the rules governing the procedures of the court?
Your Honor, it would be the rules, but we sought leave to address the matter after the hearing, and that was denied on the record.
So you seem to be implying that you're entitled to certain, quote, courtesies.
The lower court opinion does state that we were given, and the order issued does say that had the opportunity to be heard at oral argument. So I don't wish to misstate that in any way. It is just that specific to the issue of whether or not there were recovery of taxes and whether or not we could rebut those declarations that are in the record, we sought to do that, but it was after the hearing and that opportunity was denied.
Okay, here's another housekeeping question.
Yes, sir.
At 38 of the blue brief, you say inherent in any CIRA or MIRA is the further requirement that the IRS actually communicate with the informant. Based on what? The communication requirement. The way I take it, certainly the informant is entitled to confidentiality. If there's a recovery, they're certainly entitled to some recovery. But where's that communication requirement?
It's a confidential informant worried about their safety that is assigned a special agent. In these facts, there's an agreement. There's a services agreement. There's the interest in moving forward with that confidential informant under those contexts. There's also the case law we talk about where in those cases they talk about the procedures the IRS has to acknowledge a informant, go through suitability reviews, conduct debriefings, and then at the end issue a termination notice or a deactivation notice.
Yeah.
In this case, the facts also show in the record where the special agent actually sent the Internal Revenue Manual guidelines to the confidential informant, informing of the procedures that govern a whistleblower. And in those procedures, the exhibits to that manual that describes all of these things actually include sample letters of notifications of acknowledging a claim and the end of the process.
So
when Judge Kaplan in the ruling below rules that there's abandonment, that there's undisputed evidence that the agent ceased in the actions that the special agent was taking and moved forward to investigate, even though my client did not know about it, that is not a communication because my client does not know about it. The requirement is, and it's in the record, that the special agent acknowledged that from the superiors that a letter of deactivation was to go out. It did not. The record does not show that there was also an indication that the agents would do that in person and notify them. Deactivation is critical because if you're not under the care of a special, of a, an agent, you worry about your safety, right? Because you don't know what's going on. You're assigned. Safety can't be guaranteed, of course, but in the agreement, it's a critical part.
So rather than an obligation to communicate with the informant, what you're saying is an obligation to notify of deactivation.
And yes, and in the context of the facts of this case, there were communications ongoing. In the record, it's clear that from the moment of contact regarding the amendment to the agreement, under the services agreement, there is a good 6 months of communication, track phones, communications going on between, and an email. They have emails to exchange.
They certainly have the opportunity to do that.
Right. So there's my only point was that in the facts here, there's active communication, and then it stops. It's kind of what the younger generation speak to of ghosting. It's kind of like everything just goes away, okay, with no explanation. I don't mean to insult the court, but I'm talking about a term that says no explanation, poof, just go away, and the relationship's over. But there's no explanation, no courtesy, no discussion. The DeAndre Brothers case that's cited by opposing counsel in the briefs talks about the breach of good faith and fair dealing extending to a duty to cooperate. The duty to cooperate extends to this idea of communication in the DeAndre Brothers case. Opposing counsel says, but that doesn't apply here because that only applies to a special kind of contract that is cooperative. We respectfully suggest that this is also a special kind of contract that requires communication because of the health, the safety, the risk that a confidential informant acts under. Again, we're talking about whistleblowers who are anxious to know what's going on. They are entitled to worry about what's at issue. And it is our contention that this agreement...
Well, what concerns me about that is, in effect, what it's saying is it puts an investigative entity in the position of having to inform someone outside law enforcement circles of the process of their investigation, which has the potential to compromise an awful lot of what they do.
So
if we were to hold that, don't you see the problem?
Absolutely. Worry about the sovereign doctrine, worry about going too far and immersing an informant in the manner in which an investigation is conducted. But the whistleblower program requires some communication. It has to be courteous. The manual cited in the thing speaks about being truthful and being cooperative and have a professional relationship. Mm-hmm. There's nothing professional about ignoring someone, dropping them off, and saying they're not entitled to anything. No communication, nothing. Now, the agreement itself, it's our contention that because it was specially drafted to deviate from a model informant reward agreement, that it was actually drafted with great extent for 2 years, it drafted into an exception under the normal clause that some of the cases discuss that says you're not allowed to discuss matters with the informant. A special exception was added in this agreement, like the 92-932 confidential informant case, to accept out 6103 taxpayer protections and federal law. Why that was done is to permit communications, and we contend to permit the accountings. So that opens the door to that. So that's a very important drafting idea that was put in to
address
that.
If you have a breach of the duty of good faith, which is what you're talking about now, I believe, what we've been talking about.
There's, yes.
So what I'm curious to know is what are the damages? What's the harm from the breach of the duty of good faith? Hypothetically, in a case where no money was ever recovered by the IRS.
We have a value of the
pain and suffering, or what are the elements of the damages?
We understand that there's, in the civil context, a presumption of damages. There's a liability phase and a damages phase. We never got to that phase. But to answer your question, we believe the value of the contract recognized by the party entering into this very unique agreement back in 2000 went about it treating it as its value of $35 million services agreement as mutually amended, or the original information was valued at $35 million. I was asked in the court below.
Okay, I don't want to use up your time. I'm just curious. I now understand. Thank you.
And one of the things that happened in the court below was that there were statements made, for example, that...
You say on page 50 of the blue brief, Judge Kaplan decided to make use of Special Agent Tiska's workload logs to assist in establishing a recitation of the facts to form the basis of her decision. Quote, and she all but admits to the merits of the same. Where does a sitting judge all but admit to anything?
Apologize for the tone, Your Honor.
You should.
I thought about that, and what was meant was that there was a good dialogue in the court below at that hearing on August 24th about the struggle, how to get this case right. For example, one quote from the judge was, I don't think we would be here, frankly, if they just picked up the phone and answered the letter being the request from the informant, are you going to pursue the case? Please return the depositions, whatnot. But that's a lesson to be learned. Another dialogue that went on was a question about, well, if these were the facts, the dialogue went like this. CI provides really useful information to the IRS. IRS takes that information, does an investigation, and says, wow, we probably could collect a lot of money on this, but we're not happy. That's too much money. So we're going to go back and tell the informant we're not going to go bring about an enforcement action unless they agree to take less. Okay? The government in that dialogue admitted that would be a case of breach of good faith and fair dealing. Now, I'm not trying to, those things happen. They're hypotheticals in this setting. But this was in real form on August 24th, going back and forth, where I think the judge is trying to get it right with the presumption of good faith issue, with the lower court discussing how do you interwork good faith by government officials, with at the same time working on the idea of this.
You're into your rebuttal time, just so you know.
I will conclude for 1 minute and save 2 minutes for rebuttal. So the subterfuges and evasions that can go on, this court has a chance to expand that or to address that in a way that matches up with Metcalf, the reasonable expectations of an informant in this kind of situation, and ensure that benefits for a confidential informant under a service agreement are not appropriated in an improper manner in breach. I go back to everything else on brief, and I appreciate the time, and I reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you. Got a little more than that.
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you.
Ms. Floyd?
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. The issues on appeal were whether the trial court correctly applied the law of the case doctrine, whether the trial court correctly applied the summary judgment standard, and thirdly, whether the trial court correctly granted the government's motion to dismiss. I'm happy to proceed on those issues, but to direct the arguments that have been presented so far, the issue is, what is the reward agreement? What are the terms of the reward agreement? What were the obligations of the government under the reward agreement? And they were to not disclose the identity of the informant, Mr. Doe, and not to threaten to divulge.
Did you misspeak when you said that the court granted the government's motion to dismiss?
Yes.
I thought the court granted a motion for summary judgment.
On the third issue, and that is the issue of whether.
Yeah. Okay. I see. What you're saying. Yeah.
So on the first two issues,
right.
It's the government's motion for summary judgment.
So you were talking about what you believe the contract obligated the government to do?
That's correct,
Your Honor. Not to disclose the identity, protect the identity.
That's right, Your Honor. And also not to pay Doe in the event of recovery. And there was no recovery in this case. So there was no breach of that obligation to pay Mr. Doe.
What about the obligation of the government to protect the identity of the confidential informant? Is that, that starts from the time that the contract is signed, right?
That's correct.
And when does that obligation cease?
The terms of the agreement are not, it doesn't have an endpoint. So in this instance, we have protected, we've continued to protect the identity of Doe by not disclosing, by having all documents under seal, by not disclosing the identity of Doe.
Does the government's treatment of the confidential informant change depending on whether or not the government is still pursuing the matter or whether it decides to walk away entirely? For example, you have the counsel for the confidential informant suggests that there's some level of protection that's provided by the government for the confidential employee starting at day one.
There's no protection other than protecting the identity of Doe. That is, there's no individual assigned to protect Doe.
I'm glad you, because I drew an inference the other way from what counsel was saying.
No, Your Honor. The only obligation is to protect the identity of Doe. And that doesn't include a requirement to communicate, and it doesn't include a requirement to investigate.
Does it continue ad infinitum?
As far as I know, Your Honor, everything is going to remain under seal, and we have no intent to...
Well, 5 years from now, the Attorney General made a speech and said we've had a lot of confidential informants have helped us out over the years, and including them are, and he names this person.
Your Honor, my understanding is that the agreement is in perpetuity, and that is why this matter has remained under seal and will continue to remain under seal.
But to come back, you say under the umbrella of this obligation to protect the identity of this person, not to disclose the identity, there aren't any collateral promises like keep you updated about what's going on, give you a notice when we finally shut the whole thing down.
That's correct, Your Honor. There is no obligation.
There is an obligation to notify if you have something to pay.
If there's money to be paid, yes. And that's the circumstances under which Doe would be able to collect.
So the confidential informant never... The government never has to tell them that we've shut this whole thing down. We're not ever going to do anything more about your information.
There is nothing in the agreement itself. There is nothing in the manual, although the manual does have certain rules of practice for the Internal Revenue Service. It does not thereby confer upon the plaintiff or the claimant in this case the right to be notified of the close down.
Speaking hypothetically, 5 years from now, the government decides to relook at the sector in which information is provided by the confidential informant, and they say, gee, that information turns out was useful, and they pursue that sector, and they collect money at that point. Do they then notify the CI, here's some money for you?
If there is a...
I'm assuming right. In my hypothetical that there's
yes,
a correlation.
Yes, yes. It doesn't stop simply because it's been deactivated.
They're supposed to, but of course the confidential informant never knows.
That's right, Your Honor, unless there is
that's
a collection.
That's kind of a catch-22 in a way, because the government can... do some investigating and say, there's a pot of gold here, but it's not going anywhere. We'll wait another 4 or 5 or 6 years and just never answer this person again, give them the impression that we've shut the whole thing down. Then we'll go collect the money 5 or 7 years later and never bother to tell the confidential informant that we did it.
But one presumes that the trials involving that sector and the collection would be public, so that the CI would be aware
right.
that was taking place and could come back and say, hey.
There is an endpoint to the agreement. It was 1996 to 2005, and that was one of the purposes of the amendment to the agreement. But
what
the reason for the shutdown was...
What was one of the purposes?
one of the purposes of the supplemental, the amendment to the original reward agreement was to extend the years from 2000 to 2005. Another purpose was to...
So when you say extend the years, the government comes back in 2020 and goes back, can it go back before 2005 in its investigation?
It can go from 1996 to 2005, but there's a statute of limitations
right.
issue here. So
that's what I was wondering.
The question is, you know, is it, and the reason why the shutdown, the deactivation and the decision to close the proceedings was the information was stale. It was deemed to be too old to be of value. And so there was a decision no longer to pursue the information.
And was the confidential informant notified that it was deactivated? They stopped?
It eventually, yes, but it was only as a result of the Doe's inquiry as to whether there was money recovered. So there was an intent on the part of the agent to send a letter to notify that Doe was deactivated, but that letter was never sent. So it was poor management on the part of the Internal Revenue Service. But in any event, there has been no recovery in this case, so there is no breach on the part of the government, and there's been no...
I'm still going back to the duty of good faith. If the agency straps on itself the obligation to notify a confidential informant when the case is deactivated, which sounds like what was going on here, and the agent works up a deactivation letter, but it never gets sent, then is there any basis for thinking that there was an obligation to send that letter?
No, Your Honor. The manual, the Internal Revenue Manual, which does set aside certain standards of practice, doesn't have an effect of law. And moreover, even if it did have an effect of law, it was not incorporated by reference into the reward agreement. So the Doe or any other informant doesn't have that as a leverage to file a claim against the Internal Revenue Service because of failure to comply with the Internal Revenue Manual. So in this case, there was no breach of the reward agreement. There was no divulging of the identity of the informant. And there has been no recovery, so there has been no refusal or decision not to pay the informant. And for these reasons,
the case law suggests that the duty to behave in good faith isn't necessarily strictly bound to the exact terms of the contract, right?
The obligations, however, stem from the contract, and the only obligations involve the disclosure of identity and the refusal or not paying the informant. And the fallout from those particular duties do not include the duty to communicate, and they do not include the duty to investigate. So the agency has the discretion, and it must maintain the discretion to decide.
Well, that's why I'm concerned or troubled by the failure of the agent here who was felt obligated, obviously, to notify the confidential informant there was deactivation. Otherwise, the agent wouldn't have written the letter. I mean, obviously felt this is something I'm supposed to do. And it seems to me, at least hypothetically possible, that a confidential informant's behavior may change depending on whether or not the case is under active pursuit by the federal government and then when it's totally deactivated. When you call the dogs off, no pejorative intent, when you call the police investigators off the case, then the confidential informant knows that the IRS isn't out there asking a whole lot of questions anymore. That potentially exposes him to at risk in a greater way than when the investigation is quieted down. So I think there's a reason in the mind of a confidential informant why you'd like to know that the investigation is stopped.
I understand that, Your Honor, and I agree with you that it should have been disclosed to Doe. but it was a clerical error on the part of the investigator.
I don't know that we have in the record, but there must, I can't believe that the agent wrote that letter other than pursuant to some internal document that told him this is what you're supposed to do. Probably even the text of the letter is in a form somewhere.
I don't doubt that, Your Honor, but
assuming it is. Agencies can burden themselves with requirements that aren't written in the book, I mean written in the statute.
Assuming it was a manual, in the manual,
right.
That still doesn't give the plaintiff in this case, Doe, a right of action or any basis for recovery under the reward agreement. The manual itself was not incorporated by reference in the reward agreement. Moreover, in the Internal Revenue Manual...
Well, you see where I'm coming from. You know, there's an argument to be made that the confidential informant says with regard to your obligation to treat me confidentially, with regard to your treatment of me as a confidential informant, it's important to me to know whether your investigation is active or inactive.
And,
or, pardon me, active or stopped.
Well, in fact, Doe did pursue this in an effort to find out whether he or she was entitled to recovery, and it was determined that there had been no recovery.
But there's a gap. There's a gap between the time when the agent wrote the letter but forgot to mail it or whatever, and then later on when the confidential informant, by his own efforts, learns that he no longer is at least possibly subject to exposure because of a great big active investigation.
As a matter of prudence, it should have been done, and it wasn't done, unfortunately.
Thank you.
But that's not a basis for a claim in this case. Thank you. Thank you.
Your Honor, material factual dispute in the record. The discussions went on at 6457, 6454, 6455, interchanges with the court. I don't know why they didn't pursue the civil government. It didn't. It never got transferred to civil, the court, Judge Kaplan. How do I know that? Government, because Mr. Courtier says so in his declaration. That comes up again at the, I don't understand what happened after the criminal investigation closed. We have to understand what happens here. This reward agreement.
What are you citing to in the record? I'm sorry.
6457, 6454, 6455. Transcripts from the August 24, 2017 hearing on summary judgment. It was stated that the Mr. Courtier's declaration says that they did not pursue it. In fact, in the record is form 13308. And that is establishing that there was a civil referral. The declaration, let me just give this to you so that you can see it on review. Mr. Courtier's declaration 2790 to 2793 in volume 3 of the appendix. He is asked in paragraph 8, he states, at the time this criminal investigation was discontinued, I completed a copy of the form 13308 referring the matter to the IRS's civil division. We wanted the logs because it's actually contained in very private CMIS records in the criminal investigation division that is uploads the all of the agents who worked on the matter into the logs so that you can chronologically track what happened. We wanted to see what was happening when they decided to shut this investigation down criminally and refer it civilly. It is a material, factual dispute of critical importance. We do not know that they did not collect taxes. Judge, you mentioned to me that you can see press reports and so forth. Yes, if there's criminal convictions. In this industry, they were all over the place since 2000, working with ICE. We
watch
have brought that.
Oh, I'm sorry. Facts.
Oh, 17. We brought that up in the fact pattern to discuss what happened from the beginning and going forward. With the nexus, we identified an insider.
We're trying to be careful to state no facts.
I'm sorry. But anyway, the point is, we believe it's a material factual dispute, and we ask that the decision above be vacated and it remanded for further factual findings consistent with the decisions of this court.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.